Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine on Sunday, August 27th, 2023. My name is Bill McCann, and I'll begin with the talk section of the magazine with David Marchese, How to Live a Happy Life from a Leading Atheist. There's a picture of this leading atheist, Daniel C. Dennett. He's bald, wire-rimmed glasses, white beard. Looks like he's carrying a walking stick. And he looks a lot like David Letterman. For more than 50 years, Daniel C. Dennett has been right in the thick of some of humankind's most meaningful arguments: the nature and function of consciousness and religion, the development and dangers of artificial intelligence, and the relationship between science and philosophy, to name a few. For Dennett, an Amos Grise of American philosophy, who is nonetheless perhaps best known as one of the four horsemen of modern atheism alongside Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins, and Sam Harris, there are no metaphysical mysteries at the heart of human existence, no magic nor God that makes us who we are. Instead, it's science and Darwinian evolution all the way down. In his new memoir, I've Been Thinking, Dennett, a professor emeritus at Tufts University and author of multiple books for popular audiences, traces the development of his worldview, which he is keen to point out is no less full of awe or gratitude than that of those more inclined to the supernatural. I want people to see what a meaningful, happy life I've had with these beliefs, said Dennett, who's 81. I don't need mystery. David asked, right now it seems as if truth is in shambles, politics has become religion, and the planet is screwed. What's the most valuable contribution philosophers could be making, given the state of the world? Well, let's look at epistemology, the theory of knowledge. Eric Horvitz, the chief scientist at Microsoft, has talked about a post-epistemic world. That phrase, the mere fact that he could utter it, is extremely frightening. The presence of agreed-upon landmarks and sources of common knowledge, this is something we've taken for granted for a long time and can no longer take for granted. We have to work to try to restore it. How? By highlighting the conditions under which knowledge is possible. This will look off track for a moment, but we'll come around. Andrew Wiles proved Fermat's last theorem. It was one of the great triumphs of mathematics in my lifetime. Why do we know that he did it? Don't ask me to explain the complex mathematics. It's beyond me. What convinces me that he proved it is that the community of mathematicians, of which he's a part, put it under scrutiny and said, yep, he got it. That model of constructive and competitive interaction is the key to knowledge. I think we know that the most reliable path to truth is through communication of like-minded and disparate thinkers who devote serious time to trying to get the truth. And there's no algorithm for that. David says, there's a section in your book, Breaking the Spell, where you lament the postmodern idea that truth is relative. How do we decide which truths we should treat as objective and which we treat as subjective? I'm thinking of an area like personal identity, for example, where we hear phrases like, this is my truth. And the answer is, the idea of my truth is second rate. The people who think that because this is their opinion, somehow it's aggressive for others to criticize or reject them, that's a self-defeating and pernicious attitude. The recommended response is, we'd like to bring you into the conversation, but if you're unable to consider arguments for and against your position, then we'll consider you on the sidelines. You're a spectator, not a participant. You don't get to play the faith card. That's not how rational inquiry goes. This is skipping around a bit, David says, but in the memoir, you refer to the fervor around ChatGPT as a bubble. Why is it a bubble? There's an idea here that I want to talk about. In the piece that I wrote for The Atlantic on counterfeit people, I mentioned that the great danger of GPT-3 and ChatGPTs and so forth is that they can reproduce their memes. You don't have to be alive to evolve. Viruses aren't alive. Boy, do they evolve. Things evolve because they can, and cultural evolution, mimetic evolution, is a potent phenomenon. We don't want to have censorship, but we want to have something like quarantine to prevent the spread of cultural variants that could destroy culture, destroy democracy. The economist Paul Seabright writes movingly about trust, and trust is a social phenomenon. Society depends on trust, and trust is now seriously endangered by the replicative power of AI and phony interactions. This is a grave danger. There's a natural human tendency to think, if I can do it, I will do it, and not worry about whether I ought to. The AI community has altogether too many people who just see the potentiality and aren't willing to think about risks and responsibility. I'd like to throw a pail of cold water on their heads and say, wait a minute, it's not cool to make easily copied devices that will manipulate people in ways that will destroy their trust. You've written about the idea that comprehension can come out of competence. Does that imply that there's nothing stopping AI, which we currently think of as more capable of competence rather than true comprehension, from becoming sentient? Yes, strong AI is possible in principle. There's no magic. Many years ago, Giulio Chiorello, wonderful philosopher of science and journalist in Milan, interviewed me. And the headline in the Corriere della Sera the next day was, Si abbiamo un'anima, ma è fatta di tanti piccoli robot. Yes, we have a soul, but it's made of lots of tiny robots. What did you mean by tiny robots? Your brain, your whole body is made of cells. Each cell is a living agent of its own, has a sort of agenda. It's trying to stay alive. It's got to keep itself a supply of energy to keep going. It's got a metabolism. It's the descendant of a long ancestry of free-floating living cells that had to fend for themselves. And they've all joined forces to make a multicellular body. Those are little robots. If you look inside them, how do they move? How do neurons reach out and grab other neurons and send signals to them? They've got trillions of motor proteins. And motor proteins are not alive. They're macromolecules. They march along with these little highways on the brain, carrying things around. They're porters. They carry the necessary materials to keep the cell going and to repair and to extend its dendrites, for instance. Motor proteins aren't alive. Ribosomes aren't alive. Life couldn't exist without these little molecular machines. By the trillions that are working in your body right now. Human life and human consciousness are made possible by these incredibly brilliant consortia of little robots. There's a picture right under that paragraph. Four men sitting around a table. Two of them looks like they're drinking martinis. And the caption is, The Four Horsemen of Modern Atheism in 2007. Christopher Hitchens, Dennett, Richard Dawkins, and Sam Harris. And then David asks, we have a soul, but it's made of tiny robots. There is no God. These are ideas of yours that I think a lot of people can rationally understand, but the gap between that rational understanding and their feelings involves too much ambivalence or ambiguity for them to accept. What is it about you that you can arrive at those conclusions and not feel adrift while other people find those ideas too destabilizing to seriously entertain? Some people don't want magic tricks explained to them. I'm not that person. When I see a magic trick, I want to see how it's done. People want free will or consciousness, life itself, to be real magic. What I want to show people is, look, the magic of life as evolved, the magic of brains as evolving in between our own ears, that's thrilling. It's affirming. You don't need miracles. You just need to understand the world the way it really is. And it's unbelievably wonderful. We're so lucky to be alive. The anxiety that people feel about giving up the traditional magical options, I take that very seriously. I can feel that anxiety. But the more I understood about the things I didn't understand, the more the anxiety ebbed. The more the joy, the wondrousness came back. At the end of Darwin's Dangerous Idea, I have my little hymn to life and the universe. That's my God, more wonderful than anything I could imagine in detail, but not magical. Is it right that your sister's a minister? My older sister is the white sheep of the family. She went to seminary and was ordained late in her life. She's still alive. She was raised in the Congregational Church, which became part of what's now the United Church of Christ, which is religion light. If all religion were like that, all religion would be fantastic. So how do you understand religious belief? No problem at all. More people believe in belief in God than believe in God. We should recognize it and recognize that people who believe in belief in God are sometimes very reluctant to consider that they might be wrong. What if I'm wrong? That's a question I ask myself a lot. These people don't want to ask that question, and I understand why. They're afraid of what they might discover. I want to give them an example of somebody who asks the question and is not struck down by lightning. I'm often quoted as saying, there's no polite way of telling people they're devoted their life to an illusion. Actually, what I said was, there's no polite way of asking people to consider whether they've devoted their life to an illusion, but sometimes you have to ask it. There was something in your memoir that was conspicuous to me. You wrote about the late 60s when your pregnant wife had a bowel obstruction. Yeah, we lost the baby. You described it as the saddest, loneliest, most terrifying time of your life. Yes. That occupies one paragraph of your memoir. Yes. Was it indicative of you, about you or your book, that a situation you described that way takes up such a small space in the recounting of your life? Look at the title of the book, I've Been Thinking. There are hundreds of pages of stories that I cut at various points from drafts because they were about my emotional life, my trials, and so forth. This isn't a tell-all book. I don't ask about unrequited love. I don't talk about unrequited love, failed teenage crushes. There are mistakes I made or almost made that I don't tell about. That's just not what the book's about. But that brevity, I thought, is that showing something about you? I'm interested that you had that reaction. I bet you won't be alone in that. We have two adopted children. I don't talk about them much, but they are joys of our life. I'll tell you a little story. Joe Weizenbaum was very avuncular with me when we met in 1973. I was teaching at Harvard, and he was writing Computer Power and Human Reason. He was sort of my Dutch uncle for a while, giving me advice. And one day I said to him, you know, Joe, I have a strange worry. Our children are growing up in this house full of books and music and love. They're having an ideal childhood in many ways, at least by my lights. And I'm afraid that when they get to be adults, they'll be soft as grapes. I don't want to put troubles in their way, yet it worries me that I'm not giving them any troubles. He said, don't worry, Dan. They'll make their own troubles. And they did, both of them. I don't talk about those. They've overcome the obstacles they created for themselves, and I don't go into that either. But boy, I spend as much time on that as I spend on my career as a philosopher. The title of the book is I've Been Thinking. But don't your feelings affect your thinking and the philosophical ideas you pursue? Oh, absolutely. It's all, to use an old-fashioned term, driven by passion. The emotions rule. When I wrote the book with Matthew Hurley on humor, one of the great insights that Matthew gave me was that all control in human minds is via emotion. This is an important idea. Your laptop has an operating system. It's dictatorial in how it runs things. It's the traffic cop. And your brain, there's no operating system in that sense. It's all the turmoil of emotions. Happily, we have learned how to harness those emotions. That is to say, the emotions have learned how to harness one another. He laughs. But that self is at every level and at all times driven by what we might call emotions and micro-emotions. Let's see how I can put it. When you're choosing the words that come out of your mouth, slight subliminal differences in the emotional tone of one word over another, that's what's going to decide which word to use. If you're in a pissy mood, use one word. And if you're in a happy mood, use a different word. All of that is controlled by emotions. Is it possible to be objective about the ways in which our emotions drive us? Very good question. There's a conflict between objectivity and subjectivity here. You can't objectively, calmly study in yourself the heights of sexual passion. If you try, you fail. Don't try. You can think about it before or after. You can think about it in others. You can do heterophenomenology. But you can't coldly study your own passions because you need other passions to be in charge when you're doing that. Only one set of agents can be in the driver's seat at a time. A self is an individually evolved. I use the word evolved on purpose. Variety of natural selection that trains up the emotional drivers in each of us and achieves a set level of balance. It's an entente. It's a ruse of sorts that holds until it doesn't. It's a story we tell ourselves, but it's a story guided by facts. It's not just made up. We should agree with Richard Rorty and Jacques Derrida, because the ideal of objective truth in the sense of what Tom Nagel speaks about in The View from Nowhere, that's a sort of ideal that is not achievable in any meaningful way. Absolute truth, off the table. But practical truth, that's real, and that's what we're striving for. Rorty was the hero of a lot of postmodernists, and he seemed to be saying that there was no notion of truth, that it was all just conversation. I always resisted. No, there's still a good notion of truth. It's the notion of truth that you use when you say, is this a good map of the roads in the state? We can get quite objective about that. And he laughs. Rorty called that the vegetarian concept of truth. Okay, let's be vegetarians. I'll read a featured story from the magazine. How a Harvard professor became the world's leading alien hunter. Avi Loeb's single-minded search for extraterrestrial life has made him the most famous practicing astronomer in the country, and possibly the most controversial. This is a story by Seth Fletcher. On October 19th, 2017, a telescope in Maui detected something that had entered our solar system from elsewhere in the galaxy. Astronomers named it Oumuamua, Hawaiian for scout or messenger, because it was the first interstellar object they had ever recorded. The only known traveler to have crossed the vast distance between another star system and our own. Where it came from was only part of the mystery. Oumuamua fit none of the well-understood astronomical categories. If it was a rock, an asteroid, it was an extremely strange one. Researchers estimated that it was at least the length of a football field. Its shape was hard to determine, but it seemed to be long and thin, like a cigar. No known objects in the solar system had such extreme dimensions, wrote the group of astronomers who discovered the object. The more that scientists studied Oumuamua, the weirder it seemed. Analysis of its trajectory showed that in the weeks before its detection, Oumuamua sped up as it approached the sun, and its acceleration couldn't be explained by the sun's gravity alone. That extra kick would be normal for a comet. Comets are rocky snowballs, and when they get close to the sun, ice within them turns to vapor, releasing gas and giving them a boost. But Oumuamua lacked a comet's signature tail, and none of the telescopes that observed it detected water vapor, carbon monoxide, or other telltale signs of sublimating ice. Scientists started inventing wild ideas to explain Oumuamua's observed characteristics, things like hydrogen icebergs and gigantic dust bunnies less dense than air. They were reaching. Avi Loeb, a theoretical astrophysicist at Harvard University, followed the news about Oumuamua for months. Then one morning in the fall of 2018, he had an idea. For Oumuamua to accelerate as it did, something had to give it a push. What if that thing was sunlight? For years, scientists have theorized that sunlight, properly captured in the vacuum of space, could exert enough force to boost an object to incredible speeds. Nature doesn't make anything that harnesses light quite so well. But Loeb thought he might have the answer. One possibility, he and a postdoctoral researcher wrote in a paper, is that Oumuamua is a light sail. Light sails have long been proposed as a method of space travel, though as of now, they are mostly hypothetical. Japan's space agency successfully tested one in 2010. The idea is that a super thin metallic sheet could catch sunlight the way a ship's sail catches wind, propelling a craft through space. Loeb's hypothesis could explain some of Oumuamua's strange behavior, but if he was right, it meant the object was not a natural phenomenon. It was an extraterrestrial artifact. Loeb was known in the scientific community for his openness to unconventional ideas, but he was an establishment figure who had published hundreds of papers over three decades on traditional astronomical subjects. He had a reputation for finding creative ways to subject hard-to-study phenomena to the rigors of the scientific method. Avi is very good at picking problems to work on that have testable results. Robert Wilson, a Nobel Prize winner in physics, told The Times in 2014. By the time Loeb published his Oumuamua hypothesis, he had collected a stack of impressive titles at Harvard: chairman of the astronomy department, director of the Institute for Theory and Computation, director of the Black Hole Initiative. Loeb could not have been any more mainstream or credentialed, yet here he was, saying that maybe an alien spaceship has arrived. It only took a few days for camera crews to show up at his house. Since then, Loeb has made extraterrestrial life his primary research focus. In thousands of news media appearances and near daily online essays, he has called for scientists to seriously consider the possibility that aliens, or hardware they built, have visited our planet. He says scientists have a responsibility to investigate astronomical oddities like Oumuamua, as well as reported sightings of UFOs, which have recently been rebranded as UAP, or Unidentified Anomalous Phenomenon. Two-thirds of the American public believes there is extraterrestrial life, more than the 50% that believes in God, the God of the Bible, Loeb told me. Dismissing their questions are unworthy of consideration, he argues, is not a good way to earn back the trust of an American public that has become skeptical of science and scientists. There's a picture after that. It says Loeb holds his 3D print model of Oumuamua. It's reddish, pinkish red. He's holding it. Looks like it's about 12 inches by 7 inches. Kind of looks like rock. It's flat with slightly jagged edges. In 2021, with funding from private donors, Loeb co-founded the Galileo Project, a research program at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, dedicated to the search for alien technology near or on Earth. Its aims is to bring the scientific method to the realm of eyewitness testimonies, grainy Polaroids, and shady former military guys who end every debate by saying, "That's classified." Loeb is far from alone in hypothesizing that the universe could be filled with life. Astronomers now estimate that the Milky Way is home to 100 billion planets, a couple billion of which are similar to our own. It's not particularly controversial to posit that some of these planets may be home to civilizations more intelligent than we are. Because microbial life emerged soon after Earth cooled and both star systems are billions of years older than our sun, it's reasonable to imagine that life in other star systems could have been evolving eons before the first protobiological goo formed here. Where Loeb departs from almost all of his colleagues is in thinking that aliens on other planets could have already made their way to us. Loeb maintains that looking for alien spacecraft is less speculative than a lot of mainstream science. His go-to foil is fundamental physics. Since the discovery of the Higgs boson particle more than a decade ago, the multi-billion dollar particle colliders that physicists built to find postulated forces and fields have mostly come up empty. And still, Loeb says, scientists believe with quasi-religious faith that if they just build even bigger colliders, their theories will be redeemed. He reserves most of his scorn for string theorists, who, after assembling a theory of nature based on tiny hypothetical entities, have spent decades postulating extra dimensions and parallel universes, trying to make the math work. These same people, Loeb claims, refuse to consider anomalies like unexplainable interstellar objects. Out of fear or intellectual rigidity, these scientists have retreated into their own minds while ignoring strange phenomena in the real world. Loeb's outspokenness about extraterrestrial life has made him the most famous practicing astronomer in the country. His 2021 book about Oumuamua Extraterrestrial debuted in the Times nonfiction bestseller list. A new book, Interstellar, which presents contact with extraterrestrials as the next big step on humankind's evolutionary ladder, comes out this month. He has become the sort of academic star who gets invited to Richard Branson's private island and other exclusive gatherings of rich and powerful patrons interested in heterodox ideas. He's being followed by a Netflix documentary crew. Yet many in his own field consider Loeb a pariah. His more polite critics say that he's distracting from the horizon-expanding discoveries astronomers are making with new instruments like the James Webb Space Telescope. The more outspoken ones accuse Loeb of abandoning the scientific method and misleading the public in pursuit of fame. Loeb says he gets attacked from both sides, by his colleagues in the mainstream and by the UAP crazies who get upset when he dismisses their most ridiculous theories by pointing to the laws of physics. He sometimes talks about himself as a martyr. "I'm putting my body on the barbed wire," he told me. One morning in January, I visited Loeb at his three-story clapboard house in the wealthy historic suburb of Lexington, Massachusetts. He was working from home, but wearing a tailored suit, as he does most days. At 61, he is energetic and trim from a low-carb diet and a morning jogging routine that he often mentions in his emails and essays, the pre-dawn ritual where the day's ideas arrive. He offered me a bowl of blueberries and an enormous cup of coffee, which he says he doesn't drink because it would amplify his already manic pace of speaking. After talking for a couple of hours in a tidy front sitting room, he drove us to see an installation built to fulfill one of the Galileo Project's main goals, getting a high-resolution image of a UAP. Students and volunteers assembled the Galileo Project's first observatory on the roof of the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, but they recently moved it to university-owned land in the Boston suburbs. He asked me not to identify the location because he was worried about hackers disrupting or stealing the equipment. After a while, we pulled into a wooded area, parked by a stand of conifers, and walked across a snowy lawn to what looked like a high-tech Boy Scout weather station. Metal antennas stood on tripods. 8 infrared cameras were embedded within a synthetic dome the size of a charcoal grill, staring at the sky. There were visible light cameras, ultra-sensitive microphones, spectrum analyzers, and other sensors, including a Geiger counter, all of it connected to the cloud, where machine learning algorithms would scan the data for anything unusual. It was, in a sense, an elaborate wildlife camera for aliens. Astronomers have been conducting the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, SETI, since 1960, using telescopes to watch for signals from space. NASA scientists are drawing up plans to look for primitive life on certain moons of Jupiter and Saturn. Astrobiologists talk about searching for artificial light or industrial pollution on planets orbiting other stars. None of these endeavors carry stigma because they assume that if life is out there, it's out there. The boundary between mainstream astrobiology and the fringe is the idea that extraterrestrials have crossed the abyss of space to come see us, and that the governments of the world have somehow kept the evidence a secret. But governments do keep secrets, and secrecy has long fueled conspiratorial thinking about aliens and the UAPs. Leaked videos of unidentified objects taken by cameras on fighter jets are hard to make sense of, in part because those cameras are classified. The idea behind Loeb's observatory is to start building a library of unclassified data that scientists can use to study UAPs. Loeb told me that he has always had a speculative disposition. As a kid growing up on a farm in Israel, he had an uncomfortably hyperactive mind. It was like flies buzzing around in a metal box, bumping against the wall. He wanted to be a philosopher or a writer, but compulsory military service led him to science. In the Israeli Defense Forces elite Tal Piat program for academically promising recruits, Loeb studied physics and mathematics while learning to drive tanks and jump out of planes. In graduate school, he did research on weaponizing electromagnetic fields and plasmas before moving to the United States for a postdoctoral position in astrophysics at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. Starting at Harvard in the early 90s, he published prolifically on subjects such as infant black holes, the large-scale structure of the cosmos, and the universe's first stars. In 2015, Yuri Milner, a billionaire Silicon Valley investor and philanthropist, showed up at Harvard hoping Loeb could figure out how to send a probe to another star during his lifetime. Loeb was game to try. A year later, he was standing on top of One World Trade Center alongside Milner and Stephen Hawking announcing Breakthrough Starshot, a plan to attach tiny probes to micrometer-sized sheets of reflective material, light sails, and blast them with ground-based lasers, propelling them to Alpha Centauri in a couple of decades. Breakthrough Starshot, which is still in an early research phase, was what got Loeb thinking seriously about the mechanics of interstellar travel. Right around the same time that Oumuamua appeared in the sky in a cosmic coincidence, the U.S. government started talking openly about UAPs. It began on December 16, 2017, with a story in the New York Times that revealed the existence of a shadowy military UAP research program called the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program. in an accompanying article, two Navy pilots described a mystifying 2004 encounter with a flying object off the coast of San Diego, an oval-shaped craft that appeared to hover 50 feet above the frothing ocean surface before bolting out of sight. More reported sightings of unidentified phenomenon soon went public. 2019 Times article, Lieutenant Ryan Graves, a Navy pilot, described repeated encounters with unexplained aircraft off the east coast of the United States. These things would be out there all day, he said. Marco Rubio added language to the Intelligence Authorization Act of 2021, asking the Director of National Intelligence to submit a report to Congress on the subject. The Princeton astrophysicist Edwin Turner, a close friend of Loeb's, says that during the first few years of this efflorescence of UAP interest, they both watched with skeptical curiosity. Our conversation about UAP was very much along the lines of, who knows, it's not obvious, he said. It didn't seem plausible that there were extraterrestrials visiting the Earth. What made Turner think UAPs were worth investigating, he said, was the report that the Office of the Director of National Intelligence delivered to Congress in June 2021. The nine-page document described the threat posed by unidentified aerial phenomena, which included a handful of UAP that appeared to remain stationary in winds aloft, move against the wind, maneuver abruptly, or move at considerable speed without discernible means of propulsion. Loeb came across an interview in which Bill Nelson, the NASA administrator and former U.S. senator from Florida, said that he saw classified material while serving in Congress that made the hair on the back of his neck stand up. Now, I don't know how frequently the hair stands up on the back of Bill Nelson's neck, Loeb told me, but to me, it was intriguing. If Loeb's mother had been around at that point, he said, she would have tried to dissuade him from his late career turn toward alien hunting. She would say, why would you give up on everything you've accomplished? Loeb has described his mother, Sarah, as an interrupted intellectual whose family pulled her from college in Bulgaria to move to Israel upon its founding. When he and his two sisters were old enough, she continued her studies, and in Loeb's adolescent years, she took him along to college philosophy classes. They were very close. Till her death in 2019, they spoke on the phone nearly every day. I sort of realized on a personal level that up until that point, I tried to make everyone happy, he said. After my parents passed away, I said, the hell with it. I'll focus on substance. I don't care how many people like me or not like me. I would just do what seems to me is the right thing to do. Criticism from other astronomers only hardened his commitment. The more pushback that I got, the more appropriate it looked to me. Mainstream scientists might have been distancing themselves, but Loeb was discovering a different world of allies, fans, and patrons. The newly revealed government interest in UAPs got wealthy people wondering how to invest in the search for alien life. That led them naturally to Loeb. I started getting money without soliciting it, he told me. In May 2021, the Harvard Astronomy Department administrator told Loeb that an anonymous donor had given him $200,000 in research funding. Within a few days, they determined that it came from a wealthy software engineer named Eugene Zhang. Loeb arranged a Zoom call with Zhang and got another $1 million. Around the same time, Frank Lockyer, the chief executive of the scientific instrument manufacturer Bruker, who had read Loeb's book Extraterrestrial, showed up on his front porch in Lexington. Together, they decided to establish the Galileo Project. The observatory near Boston has been running for several months. They were still training the machine learning algorithms to identify birds, planes, and other common airborne objects. The goal is to install up to 100 such observatories around the world. So far, Loeb has obtained funding to install 5 more stations in the United States. While the dream is to get the first megapixel quality photo of something anomalous, he says he expects almost everything these instruments detect to be mundane. The Galileo project is completely agnostic, has no expectations, he told me. I asked him how an experiment like this could ever deliver a convincing negative result. A failure to photograph a UAP would never convince a believer that there are no alien ships in the sky, only that the aliens were smart enough to avoid Loeb's camera trap. If we search the sky for 5 years, 24/7, and see nothing unusual except for birds and drones and airplanes, and we do it at tens of different locations, maybe 100 locations, he said, then we move on. A week after Loeb showed me the observatory, I joined a planned meeting for another Galileo Project initiative, an effort to retrieve an unusual meteorite that had fallen to Earth several years ago. Amir Siraj, a Harvard undergraduate working with Loeb, identified a curious entry in a government meteor database. On January 8, 2014, an object exploded near Papua New Guinea. Its orbit suggested an origin outside our solar system, though it was impossible to say for sure because the government satellites that detected it were classified. In 2022, after a lot of prodding from Loeb, the U.S. Space Command released a letter saying with 99.999% confidence that the Papua New Guinea fireball was interstellar. The government also published the meteor's light curve, a graph of its brightness over time. From this, Loeb concluded that it had exploded so close to the Earth's surface that it must have been made of something much harder than normal meteors, maybe even an artificial alloy like stainless steel, which made him wonder, what if it was an extraterrestrial probe, and could he find its remains? If anything was left of this meteor or extraterrestrial probe, it was scattered across the seafloor north of Papua New Guinea. When meteors burn up in the atmosphere, the molten remains condense into sand grain-sized orbs called spirules that cascade to Earth like glitter. The logistics of searching for those spirals under several thousand feet of water were daunting, but there was reason to think it could be done. 2018, scientists used remotely operated vehicles and a magnetic rake to find spirals from a meteor that had fallen off the coast of Washington. Encouraged by that project, Loeb and Siraj started thinking about going after the Papua New Guinea meteorite. Charles Hoskinson, a mathematician who made a fortune in cryptocurrency, heard Loeb talking about the meteor on a podcast and pledged $1.5 million for the search. To figure out the logistics, they hired EOS Expeditions, the company that helped the director James Cameron dive to the Pacific Ocean's 36,000-foot deep Mariana Trench. They planned to go to sea later in the spring. Loeb ran the planning meeting on Zoom from his home office. He started by telling the group about a conversation he just had had with Hoskinson, whose $1.5 million donation was, until that week, an undeposited promise. Loeb met with him 2 days earlier to get a final commitment. It was quite nerve-wracking, Loeb said. Hoskinson asked hard questions about their chances of success. The plan was to drag a magnetic studded sled along the seafloor to collect the spherules. But what if the remains weren't magnetic? Loeb explained that they would have nets attached to the sled to catch particles the magnets missed. Hoskinson was not reassured. Could they do better than nets? Could they dredge or use some sort of sluicing device? To appease Hoskinson, Loeb agreed that the magnet sled engineers would design a supplementary sluicing device. Loeb got the go-ahead. He told the group that the money would soon be transferred to the expedition's bank account. Still, Loeb seemed a little shaken by the difficulty of closing the deal. "Anyone who knows me knows that I'm task-oriented rather than promise-oriented," he said. It was as if he was only then internalizing the idea that private donors expect a return on their investment. "The nightmare scenario is that we go there and find only muck." The first step in avoiding the nightmare scenario was to search the right area, and that would be difficult enough. The location data they had for the meteor came from military satellites that watch for incoming nuclear missiles. Every measurement on every instrument has some margin of error, which is why a huge amount of scientific work involves calibrating instruments and working with uncertainty. But the margin of error for the missile-spotting satellites was classified. If they relied solely on government data, they would be left searching 50 square miles with a magnetic sled smaller than a golf cart. Loeb told the group that he and Siraj thought they had found a way to shrink the search area using seismometer readings and a lot of math. Even so, Robert McCollum, the cheerful New Zealander who runs IOS, later conceded to me that the hunt would be challenging. The complexity lies in the fact that no one knows what it is we're looking for. We assume that it's a few shovels full of small black particulate spread over a mile, 2 miles, 10 miles. The expedition would depend to an unusual degree on luck. Loeb's theory about Oumuamua, the baffling interstellar object that set him on his late career course as an alien hunter, was always controversial among his colleagues, and not just because it evoked alien technology. Karen Nish, an astronomer at the University of Hawaii and the lead author on the Oumuamua discovery study, had a long list of complaints about Loeb's paper. First was its rhetorical mode. "I would have been okay with that first paper had at the very end," then he said, "this is puzzling. We don't have a very good explanation. Let's speculate on what would it take to provide enough evidence for us to go the route of extraterrestrials." Instead, she said, Loeb's case consisted of, "I'm just declaring that it's with no evidence whatsoever." She pointed out that Oumuamua's light curve showed that it was wobbling like a top. "I'm not a sailor, but if you've got to keep the sail pointing in the correct direction." Beyond that, Loeb's critics argued that his proposal was physically unrealistic. Even if Oumuamua was made of the least dense artificial solid material known to humans, it would still be roughly 10 times denser than his math required and was preposterously slow for an interstellar spacecraft. "You don't leap to its alien technology before you've exhausted everything thoroughly," Meech said. "And I get the feeling that Avi's so excited about his ideas that he picks out bits of the observation that fit and discounts the others that do not." She continued, "That's what we're trying not to teach young students to do, because that's not science." Late March, as Loeb was preparing for his trip to the South Pacific, two American scientists published a paper in Nature proposing a new natural explanation for Oumuamua. The study described how a small comet that had spent eons drifting among the stars could become something like Oumuamua, and how, in the little time they had available to study it, astronomers wouldn't have been able to figure that out. It was written by Jennifer Bergner, an astrochemist at the University of California, Berkeley, and Daryl Seligman, a postdoctoral researcher in astrophysics at Cornell University. Together they made the following case. In the unimaginable cold of interstellar space, the ice in a comet takes on a fluffy, amorphous form. When this porous ice is cooked by radiation, which happens continuously in the cold furnace between stars, bubbles of hydrogen form inside. As Oumuamua got close to the sun, the warmth rearranged the molecules in the ice, releasing some of the trapped hydrogen. The escaping gas gave Oumuamua a shove, causing the unexplained acceleration. Headlines around the world declared the mystery of Oumuamua all but solved. In a news release from the University of California, Berkeley, Seligman said, "We had all these stupid ideas like hydrogen icebergs and other crazy things, and it's just the most generic explanation." I'm not going to be able to finish that story this week, so I'll save the ending till next week, and I'll read from the ethicist and Judge John Hodgman. And the ethicist, the letter says, "My sister thinks prayer will cure my cancer. How do I talk to her?" The magazine's ethicist, columnist on relating to a sibling with a radically different worldview. The ethicist is Kwame Anthony Appiah. And the letter says, "A year ago, I was told I had a form of ovarian cancer and was given 2 to 3 years to live. 5 years if I'm in the top quartile of patients. I nursed my husband through metastatic lung cancer for 15 months. It was horrific. I'm hoping that God takes me early. My sister, who I love very much, is part of a fundamentalist Christian church and is one of their top prayer warriors. As such, she calls me nearly every day and launches into long prayers, asking God to send my cancer to the foot of the cross. She implores me to pray with her and says that if I just believe that God will cure me, he will. I grew up Catholic and have fallen away from the church. I believe God is bigger than what we can understand as human beings. I'm a data-driven healthcare practitioner. I believe that everybody has to die of something, and this happens to be my fate. I've told her as tactfully as I can that her praying for me and expecting me to pray with her for my cure is upsetting to me. Makes me feel that if there is a God, he must really hate me. Otherwise, he would have cured me. She says that he wants to use me as a messenger to others, and that it's the devil, not God, who gave this disease to me. Also, I had a pretty abusive marriage, and I'm a little freaked out that if there is life after death, my husband will have the opportunity to abuse me more in the afterlife. What do I say to my sister without belittling her beliefs? I've told her that if she wants to pray for me, I would rather she do it on her own time and not ask me to participate. But she's persistent, thinking that she's going to save my soul and my body at the same time. She disputes every reason that I give her and insists that what she is doing is helpful. But it's not helpful. It sends me into a terrible depression." And the ethicist writes, "Yours isn't the stereotypical clash between believer and skeptic. You're a believer of sorts, as your anxieties about meeting your late husband established. Let me assure you that on the standard Christian view, as the Catholic and Protestant clerics I conferred with agree, you would not be subject to your late husband's abuse in the afterlife. What you don't believe is in a personal God or the power of intercessory prayer. Given that your sister very much does believe in these things, what she's doing makes sense. And that's why this clash is so difficult. Hers is the good-hearted action of a devoted sibling. You're making your arguments at this point. You should simply let her know that you find her calls to prayer dispiriting and that you want to spend your remaining time making peace with your condition, not spending your energy in what you consider a futile effort to deny reality. You can tell her all this firmly, but tenderly and without bitterness, acknowledging that she's been acting out of her love for you. You could ask others in the family to support your request as well, if you think that would make a difference. Even the staunchest of believers struggle with doubt, and your prayer warrior sister may also be having a hard time accepting your mortality. The idea that she can't do anything about it may pain her. Whatever the explanation, though, you may have to tell her that if she calls to pray with you, you're just going to put the phone down. The situation is already difficult. The sister's convictions and her love for you don't entitle her to make it worse. What you need from her now is a particularly exacting kind of love, the kind of love that sets aside its own convictions out of respect for the convictions of another. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org or by calling 303-786-7777.